Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It is Monday, May 19th. Today we look at what the tariff hikes could do for a small company as we mark Small Business Month in May, how one shop is telling its customers about price hikes. Hula and Health, what studies over two decades can teach us about prevention and rehabilitation. We'll explore this topic over the next 2 days. Magic and Menehune abound in a new young adult novel set on the Big Island, how the author wrote herself into the story. And the new live-action Lilo and Stitch film premiered this weekend in California, why it's reigniting a long-simmering casting controversy. President Donald Trump doubled down on his tariff policy over the weekend, demanding in a social media post that businesses like Walmart eat the tariffs and not pass along costs to consumers, as the company said it would do. But how are smaller stores weathering the storm? May is Small Business Month, and so we thought we'd check in with some of our local entrepreneurs to see how they're navigating the economy. One small business isn't backing down from letting its customers know how tariffs are affecting pricing. Adam Kurtz and Mitchell Cougar recently opened Small Kind Gift in Kaimuki. One of their recent Instagram posts about tariffs sparked some online feedback. The Conversations UW Gibson sat down with the two small business owners to learn more.
It really started as a fun, creative project between Adam and I. We really felt like we had the time and the space to devote to creating an experience for people to come in and to spend anywhere between $2 or $200 to get little things for themselves or for other people. We sell everything from books to snacks to little knickknacks to trinkets. And I think the ethos of the shop is really childhood things that spark joy. I think there's a lot of nostalgia in the shop. I think there's a lot of like fun local things that allow people to think about their own childhoods here. And I think there's a lot of tension also between our experiences, or my experience anyway, of growing up here as a local person, but then also leaving for a long time, and then coming back and feeling like there wasn't a lot of spaces that reflected that experience.
Adam, I know a recent Small Kind Gift Instagram post was focused on the topic of the day, if you will, tariffs. Tell us about that post and how it came about.
One of our most popular items are these highly realistic fake food keychains from Japan. We can't keep them on the shelves. We are constantly reordering them. And the most recent package, UPS wouldn't release it unless we paid a $350 bill. And that was the first taste of this sort of tariff thing.
And that was specifically labeled as a tariff bill.
This was a tariff bill. And unlike some shipments where duties are paid in advance, you have an awareness of what the import fee might be. This was a surprise. And again, these are keychains. This is small margins. We are the smallest of small businesses. So I posted a screenshot of that bill and I said, hey, these might be the last keychains for a minute and here's why. And then very small, I wrote something to the effect of, hate to be political, but why don't we just tax billionaires? If it's about tax income, don't charge me $350 for keychains. Just see if Jeff Bezos or whoever is willing to pay their fair share. That post did get a little bit of attention. One woman did reply and she said, yeah, piece of advice, don't get political. And that just kind of set me off.
How did you react to that once you were set off?
First, Mitchell and I had a conversation about whether or not I should put a screenshot of her message because I was ready. I was ready to post about how anti-billionaire is upset, which that's a joke. I don't think she's a billionaire. I'm not sure why she's in defense of billionaires.
Did she offer to pay the tariffs?
She didn't, but I wanted to ask her, hey, if you have a couple $1,000, we'll take it. But after calming down, I did decide to post further about the tariffs, I think because a lot of people maybe aren't aware of how that might be impacting them personally. And I wanted to be really transparent. Our shop prioritizes affordable, accessible, small-scale gifts, trinkets, little cute things where you can come in with $4 and leave with three things. Whether you're a child and $4 is a lot of money or you just need a little treat that's not sugar, maybe. And that's going to change out of necessity. And I wanted to explain why. We're not making more money. We're actually making less. And you're being taxed. We're just calling it a different word.
You received that invoice. Have you received other similar invoices since that first one?
Gratefully, we haven't had any surprise invoices, but we have had rising costs either in initial quotations, which prevented us from placing orders. Now we're playing this fun game of what items from China are already stateside and how long will that supply last? And so I think every business is facing this weird situation of, okay, the warehouse, we got 10 months supply in here and then it's going to suck. So that's been an issue. We order a lot of little toys and keychains. One of the things that we're known for is our trinket lei, which is essentially a candy lei that's half toys. And nobody in America is making 1-inch bouncy balls and injection molded sailboats and acrylic frogs. That's all coming from China. And so the idea that we should just order made in the USA is not possible. But we do order those from an American toy vendor on the East Coast. And our most recent order, they quoted us a $300 shipping charge, which is insane. And I asked them, what is the shipping charge? And we were told the shipping and handling charge reflects the tariff increases. There is no American manufacturer for a lot of these little sort of cheap things that we sell, that we love.
And that's the idea, right? The idea is that you're going to go to an American supplier, but what you're saying is that's simply not available to you.
I don't think American manufacturing is set up to produce tiny Snoopy-shaped charms at scale. This is not what American manufacturing is going to do. No one's going to stop going to China. It's just the margins are going to shrink. And that's kind of what we're bracing for. We're not going to stop using some of our vendors. It's just going to cost us more. And we have to make a judgment call. Do we pass that increased cost onto our customer or not? In the case of our shop, where 50% of the shop is under $10 by design, increasing things a dollar or two, I don't think our customers care, but we really care. That matters to me. This is an expensive place to live. We really wanted to make a place that was very fun and very cool and very affordable. That is the goal. And it's harder now.
We're not a kid shop, but we do have kids who come in with the $5 that their parents gave them to come in. And they definitely have a very limited amount of things that they can buy. And I feel like that just shrinks. And that part is sad.
Yeah, that's the best part of our shop is parents give the kids like $5 bills and kids spend 10 minutes going through all 80 drawers of our small kind drawers and they have to do the math. It's really like a beautiful educational tool that reminds me of going to a dollar store with my grandmother whose photo's on the wall. And that experience for young people is shrinking. We prioritize it.
Mitchell, we get a lot of stories in national news about how tariffs affect big items and big companies, Ford Motor Trucks and this kind of thing, big scale. But paint a picture for us in terms of what kind of spot the tariffs put a small business like yours in. What kind of leverage do you have?
It feels like we have none.
Yeah, we don't really have leverage. We're an incredibly small business. And I have about a decade of experience of printing books and stationery in China as an independent artist. Globalization and, I don't know, the internet and vendor marketplaces like Alibaba have made this really accessible and leveled the playing field for super small business. And we don't have leverage, right? I'm not Walmart. I can't negotiate at scale. I kind of get what I get when I get it. And that's actually been great. That's worked out just fine. And this really does impact our ability to negotiate in that way. I will say something that's always been important to me is understanding that made in China is not this like amorphous idea. China is a real place with real people who are working in real factories. And the idea now that, oh, the Chinese manufacturer will eat some of the tariff cost is like, should they have to? They're already paid less for their labor. That's the whole thing. Now we're going to ask them to pay even less so that the U.S. government can earn more tax revenue that they could be getting elsewhere. I mean, the whole thing is really gross.
I really like how you point out this sort of dehumanizing quality that's incorporated into how we talk about tariffs and goods from China and who makes them, because China has centuries, to their credit, of making goods and inventing goods.
Yes, I have said this so many times over the years, but China invented paper. Why would I print books in America? That doesn't make sense to me. And I'm not the only one who agrees. It's because they have advanced manufacturing. They have great processes in place. They are a world producer of goods, not just because of cost, but because they have advanced manufacturing. They're very good at what they do. But one thing that's important to remember is, yeah, real human people on both ends. In the same way that we're a real small business feeling the impact, there are our sales associates and contacts that I've worked with for 8 to 10 years who are also feeling that impact. I'm getting emails from vendors like, hey, been a minute, hope all is well. Any new projects come? And it's, I have no doubt that they are seeing business shrink, and there's a lot of impact on both sides.
Americans often speak out both sides of their mouth, right? We say, oh, goods from China, just cheaply manufactured. But at the same time, we say, give us more, give us more. I think it's that in some ways might capture the sort of lack of more sophisticated thinking on the topic that we could be doing or considering in terms of how we can interact with this other country and what they produce for us.
We went to China last year for the first time, and we didn't go for work purposes, but I feel like that gave us both some insight, no?
And then speaking about like the relationships, it's like over the years, I have seen boxes arrive at our apartment that's like from China wishing us like a happy new year with a beautiful scarf, or we got like a really brightly lit up lamp once as
I forgot about that lamp. You remember? And one time she sent like a tea infuser bottle that you used for years. Yeah, that's a real person. She sent pictures of her kids.
Yes. And so I think that relationship is very real. And they're very grateful for that relationship.
We have really cute shopping bags at Small Kind Gift, and they're cute because the woman at the bag company comped us the second side printing as a gift. She was like, I thought it would look better, so we just kind of did it, and we're not going to charge you extra. I mean, these are real people.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts that strike you about the dynamics that we've been talking about that I haven't asked you directly about that you'd like to add to the conversation?
I just want to emphasize, like, when I say small, I really mean we're small. It's basically my husband, Adam, and I, who are running the shop, and our dog is also there, and he is a CFO, but he's officially not on the books. So it is very much like a very small human operation. And basically, when you come in, you will see one of us there, and you will have a conversation about the space that we created. And I feel like that is what makes the place so special, and it is what people are connecting with. And these impositions on what can happen financially do affect that ability in some ways.
I appreciate that Mitchell talked about our scale. I mean, small is in the name, but we are really small by design. It would have been more cost effective to simply not do this. But we really felt like it deserves to exist and it would be really fun. We don't expect to be profitable for quite some time, but we just love this. And so the tariffs are just a further setback. And so maybe we won't break even until 2027. But I don't know. It's very Kaimuki. It's that mom and pop thing. We are really benefiting from the Keep It Kaimuki campaign where people are walking around Wailea getting the vibe. And we're so happy to be part of it. And the tariffs just make it that much harder to exist.
I do want to emphasize that we do work with local artists, that we do work with local vendors. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of the things that we're talking about when we talk about local nostalgia, they still come from China. I mean, we sell finger traps, Chinese finger traps. That is something that I had when I was a kid. That's from China in the name.
We do support a lot of local products, both Hawaii local and U.S. local. But even local snacks are packaged in packaging that's made in China. We make our own Liheng lemon peel gummies. The printed bags come from China. So even if you are made locally, made in Hawaii, components are still coming from China. That's kind of the reality for, I think, a vast majority of businesses and manufacturing in this country. Because we live in a global world. And I think the current administration understands this innately. I think that the tariff thing is really very much about having bargaining chips and holding power. I don't know if you guys know this, but there's a lot of power plays that happen in government. You heard it here first. I'm actually one of the political geniuses of our generation. I just choose to sell keychains. Yeah.
You got to start somewhere. No, but I feel like what your shop embodies too is this truth that when we talk about globalism, we're often talking about globalizing capitalism, economy and money and flow of money. But you both are talking about globalism in a more holistic sense, in the sense of sort of exchange of cultures and human beings on the other end of the line, so to speak, engaging you in products or ideas or creativity, a more expansive idea of how different cultures and different economies can interact with each other.
That's a beautiful way to put it. When I think about Hawaii, I mean, this is a place that is a product of a vast number of cultures that have arrived here from different parts of the world, joined the folks that were here already, and kind of created local culture as we know it.
That was HPR's D.W. Gibson. He spoke with Adam Kurtz and Mitchell Kuga, who run Small Kind Gift in Kaimuki.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
AI companies are running out of high-quality data to train their models, but they say they might have a solution.
I do think in the future, it seems quite possible that more of training for these big models is actually inference generating synthetic data to then go feed into the model.
What happens when you train your AI on AI-generated data? That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Learn more at scheidler.hawaii.edu.
A recent public health study found that 1 in 4 people in Hawaii have danced hula at some point in their lives. That's just one of the interesting things we discovered doing a story about Hula for Health. Mele Luk is Director of Community Engagement and Researcher with the Department of Native Hawaiian Health at the University of Hawaii Medical School. And for the last 20 years, that department has built on research that started with the cardiologist and heart health. It has since expanded to preventative care and more. Here's Luk.
From early on, the kumuhulas told us how intertwined kumuhula and kumuhula lineage was with healer lineage, right? In terms of be it midwives or be it other aspects of health in the legends and stories about bringing life, bringing health.
Tell us maybe for our listeners who don't know, you know, how did this research project really get started?
It came from an intersection of my own interest in health professionally, and then I was going through an uniki with Kumu Mapuana de Silva in our halau Muhala Ilima. It's an intensive, immersive training session. And so I started really thinking how hula has so much health aspects and how when we develop programs of health interventions, it's very similar to how Mapuana de Silva structured her session classes, which were 3-month classes, to get people oriented to hula. And so I brought that up in a brainstorming session we had one time for a big center grant. And there was several kinds of responses along the spectrum. Some people didn't think NIH would be very responsive at all to that idea. And others, and I credit Dr. Todd Sito, who's a cardiologist at Queen's and an excellent researcher, said, I can work with that. And his interest was cardiac rehab because cardiac rehab was shutting down in the islands. There was, I think at that time, Castle was closing their formal cardiac rehab program. And so he was interested in looking at hula could be something that could be served as a form of cardiac rehabilitation. And so that's what we did our first proposal to NIH that was granted for 5-year funding to look at this. And we developed the groundwork for what we are still building on now in terms of what does a hula and health program look like? What does hula-based health intervention look like, especially for heart health?
And so that was the first go-around. And it's been 20 years since you folks launched that, and you just held a webinar, and you now have some of that data on the website?
Yes, we have a lot of our papers. We have a dozen or so foundational studies and then outcome studies and from scientific journals, but we also have a lot of our materials that we've used in classes and developed programs for. So the whole educational curriculum, as well as how we outlined what a hula class, the different aspects look like and guidance and training. In the webinar, I highlighted like 7 areas of hula that improve health, that at least that we've studied and be able to have scientific evidence for. I mean, I think the kumuhula elaborate a lot more in terms of what the aspects are, but we focused on what we can bring together, science and culture together, and be articulated through the language of science. So we started off talking to the kumuhula, right? Go to the source. And so when we talked to them, they said, which was the quintessential Hawaiian view of health, that hula brings health to mind, body, and spirit, that hula involves emotional health, spiritual health, physical health, as well as cognitive health. That was very clear from their studies that that's how they brought it together, and that they said the dancers will improve and get connected with this aspects of health at different stages of their training and the different ages that the dancer is at. So it's that combination that will get them to a point where they become aware of how it's health and benefit for them. We did a lot of analysis of hula, the physical health aspects, but they also talked about the spiritual health aspects of it and the emotional health, how familial environment of a hula halau, where it's your hula's brothers and sisters, that kind of support is very important for your emotional well-being, and that hula forms a community. And I think now we know where, you know, our last Surgeon General said social isolation is an important health issue. And so through hula, you can form that community and get strength from that community. So that was a second one. And then hula as a physical activity. So we went into depth and looked at hula and its metabolic equivalent, which is a scientific way of saying what is the energy expenditure of hula. And it's been measured for hundreds of different activities, but it had, at the time we were looking at it, hadn't been defined for hula. So we undertook a study with a very high-tech intakes of oxygen breath and on a mobile device, and found that hula overall is considered a moderate or vigorous physical activity. And that beginning hula, which, you know, as a dancer, right, Puamana, Kavika, those are beginner dancers, that is about the equivalent of fast walking, maybe a pickup basketball game, getting to that level. And then competitive hula or high intensity hula is at the like Mary Monarch dancing level. And it is going towards a competitive tennis game or a competitive basketball game.
Right. You've got stamina.
Right.
Burst of power.
Right. And what the kinesiology professors at UH explained to us is the bent knee stance. So you're in constant bent knee, and then you're elevating your arms above your heart, which will raise your heart rate. So all that iuka, all that mountain motions really bring a lot of energy expenditure. That was very interesting to have that scientific lens on it and understand it in that way. So the more we understood that balance and that scientific lens, is understand how to apply it to a health intervention. So how to develop or see how hula could be used as a physical activity for a big range of limitations that people have, either elderly have kupuna hula or have a heart condition, and how we can change that. So our second major study was looking at hypertension, high blood pressure management. Because after the cardiac rehab study, the communities we work with said, you know, they wanted us to focus on prevention, not at the worst cases, but before it happens. So we pivoted to this prevention for heart disease and stroke, which is prevalent in a lot of populations in Hawaii, especially Native Hawaiians. And had a very successful study among the best of non-medication interventions for high blood pressure control. It was really, when you look at the list of other effects like the DASH diet, which is well known for modifying your salt intake to reduce your blood pressure, hula was about 15 points we dropped, the participants dropped in their systolic blood pressure, which was remarkable. And what experts said was what was even more remarkable is after the study ended, 3 months out when they were totally on their own, they maintained that improvement.
Wow. So it really stuck with them.
It really stuck with them.
And so, you know, when you think about the strides that you made over 2 decades and the funding from the National Institute for Health, because of the climate that we're under and you're hearing about all these programs, you know, getting cut, you know, what lies ahead for Hula for Health?
One thing we know, which is part of like the blessing and the wonderful part of the Hawaiian culture and hula, is hula is for everyone. And a study I've worked with our Department of Public Health at the University of Hawaii, that we looked at how prevalent is hula across the population of Hawaii. And it was remarkable. 25% of the population in Hawaii said they danced hula sometime in their life, which is huge. Where else are you going to find, you know, an entire state who one out of every four person can say they danced hula? And so I think that shows the universality of hula. And hula has always accepted, you know, it doesn't matter what ethnicity you are. Your kumu looks at you as an individual dancer. So it's been challenging to think about, because it's a cultural dance, if it might be not as many funding opportunities for future studies or future, more importantly, future implementation in the community. We're hoping that because hula is for everyone, that it won't be as restricted, that it'll be seen as a community dance and not just for a specific ethnic group.
And it doesn't really matter what ails you. The health benefits you've shown over time studying this are positive.
We can say scientifically it's been very well proven for your heart health. And we're expanding that. Other scientists in Hawaii are looking at hula in terms of a hula-based program for breast cancer survivor recovery. And also, I just started out of the Queen's Medical Center is looking at a program of hula for Parkinson's disease as an alternative or an addition to physical therapy.
Wow. So then what started as a very humble, let's try it, let's see what it does for the heart, now can be expanded.
Yes. And also we think, you know, we know that our work is being watched globally. You know, when we came out with our results for the high blood pressure study, our press releases and information got 2 million views. So we know there's a lot of interest in non-medication approaches. And we're hoping to inspire and give a roadmap to other cultures and other countries to use their cultural practices, especially their dance practices, but other cultural practices, to look at ways that that can be a foundation for health intervention.
That was Mele Luke of the Department of Native Hawaiian Health at the John A. Burns School of Medicine. She was discussing her research into the connections between hula and health. We'll have links to that recent webinar featuring the 20-year study on our website later today. Tomorrow, we plan to highlight a halau of cancer survivors, one of the many ripples that Hula for Health has inspired across the community. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Later in the show, we'll be highlighting some of the discussion around casting for the live-action version of Lilo and Stitch. The movie was filmed here in Hawaii, including a week-long shoot at Kaneohe Bay. It features Zach Galifianakis and Courtney B. Vance, but there are also some new faces in the movie, including an 8-year-old performer from the island of Hawaii, making her big screen debut. This rising star was selected for the role of Lilo after an open casting call for a young girl who loves hula, surfing, and wildlife with a special affinity for all things gross. This former participant in the Little Miss Kona Coffee program was a perfect fit. For today's quiz, we want to know, who is this young actress who will be playing Lilo in the live-action Lilo and Stitch? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Hey.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
It's been called an epic adventure steeped in Hawaiian lore. The novel is titled The Invisible Wild, and it was released this month. Big Island author Nikki Vandekaro has published 10 books on magic and crafting, but this is her first young adult novel. She spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about making the plunge into YA and telling a story that felt close to home.
The character in The Invisible Wild, Emma, she's part Hawaiian. She's growing up in Volcano on the Big Island. She reads too much and watches Pride and Prejudice over and over. So, you know, it wasn't too difficult for me to put myself back there and think about that time. She was someone who didn't really feel like she could connect with what it means to be Hawaiian. You know, she doesn't surf. She doesn't speak Olelo. And she constantly has people around her telling her again and again that she's not really Hawaiian. And that she doesn't belong here, basically.
And that struck home. That kind of speaks to your experience.
Yeah, it still happens. You know, when I was growing up, I didn't have like a pidgin accent. I was an Anglophile. Like it didn't really like make sense. And I didn't look Hawaiian, although what does that even mean anymore, really? You know, but I always had like a deep sense of place, even though I had people telling me that. Like when I would tell people that I'm actually Hawaiian, I do know these things. People would literally like not believe me and would explain to me like, you know, that saying you're Hawaiian doesn't mean like from Hawaii, right? You know, it means like, you know, indigenous. And I was like, yes, I understand the concept. It was tricky. It's still difficult sometimes.
Yeah. And then how did you think about writing about that experience? Either from like a therapeutic healing inner child lens or at the end of the day, like being an author is selling books. So how do you write about that for an audience?
Well, I'm honestly wondering how this is going to go because it's such a very specific book of place. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, a sense of not feeling fill in the blank enough is something that's pretty common wherever you are. When I was growing up and now I had such a deep connection to Hawaii. You know, I went to college on the mainland and I lived in New York for 15 years, but then we came back here, back to Volcano 8 years ago. And I'm so glad to be back here. It was where I wanted to raise my kid. They're now at Kamehameha on the Big Island. And it's really where I wanted to be. And it's such a big part of our identity, even if we experience it in different ways.
Tell us, if not the Spark Notes version of the plot, kind of inside cover.
Sure. Yeah. 16-year-old girl, Emma, when she was a little kid, she could see and experience things that others couldn't, like mo'o climbing waterfalls, poi dogs, and menehune. But as she got older, she heard people telling her, oh, she's got such an amazing imagination, la, la, la. So she figured she was just imagining all of that. And so she stopped seeing them. And then what happens is she meets this boy from Hilo and he's kind of lost his mind. He's been cursed and he's living alone in the forest. He can't really communicate, but he can see all of the things that she used to see. He's talking to the menehune. And so she makes a questionable choice to not call for help for him. She leaves him there knowing that it's wrong because she's hoping that he can bring that gift back to her, that she'll be able to see and talk with them again, too. And, you know, she brings him food and sleeping bags, but it's not great. But she does come to be able to speak with the menehune, and they set her and the Hilo boy on a task. And it's something that really kind of helps her embrace her Hawaiian identity and her own power to make a difference for our aina and, you know, for the menehune, of course.
And so magic, folklore, all of this mo'olelo play a huge role in this book. What would you say your relationship is with magic?
Oh, So I've written some other books before. This is my first novel, but the nonfiction books I've written are, they're pretty witchy. They're intended for people who are curious about magic and want to live a more magical life, whatever that looks like. So I sort of write a lot about how to invite magic into the everyday, whether that means cooking with rosemary for remembrance or like stirring your pasta sauce Wittershins to the left to invite more intuition, things like that, things that are very achievable, but still like actually in a very sort of indigenous way where spirituality is just a part of your existence.
That's cool. And then how did you novelize it? Like translate some of the quite practical magic into a young adult novel?
That aspect didn't really come in, but more what you were talking about before, kind of the folklore. Kanaka Maoli stories are so important. They inform so much of how we understand the world here. And I think that's true wherever you are, wherever you're from. Our stories are what tell us who we are. And so I wanted my story to reflect that, to be in conversations with the legends that I grew up reading and being told. So, you know, there are legends of Naupaka, the legends of Laka and the canoe kind of help Emma sort of solve the problem and figure out what to do. It's like just sort of taking in all of this folklore and reinterpreting it in a more modern way that can help the unreal, imaginary, and then the very real and concrete exist at the same time. And that's actually what the title, The Invisible Wild, is about. It's about that thin, thin space between what we tell stories about and we believe are true and what we, you know, live in and exist and are facts. So it's about that dissonance and also that harmony.
Yeah. There's a passage from the novel early on. I wanted to read it to you and have you respond. This is from Emma's perspective, and what you write is, "There is nothing quite so arrogant as living in a town called Volcano and expecting it to be safe to do so. But in truth, nowhere was entirely safe, and everyone who lived on the Big Island understood that we were all subject to Pele's choices." Is that Emma talking? Is that you talking?
It's both, for sure. I mean, I could see the glow at night out my window. And, you know, technically we're like, Volcano is uphill from Kilauea a little bit, but we are on the slope of Mauna Loa, which, you know, could go off again at any time. It's pretty funny. When we were moving out here, my husband's family was all like, "Wait, wait, wait, but you can get home insurance, right? For the volcano." I'm like, "Oh, no, no, no. That's not a thing." I guess because I grew up with that threat, and again, like, it really is true that wherever you are, there's some sort of problem. You know, there are the fires in California, there's, you know, storms all up and down the coast. Nature's going to do what it's going to do. And certainly there's an aspect of climate catastrophe that I don't want to ignore. And it's sort of comforting, actually, to think that the volcano has nothing to do with that. That's just the earth doing what it does. And so we just live with that question of, it's okay. It's what happens. I mean, that's my experience of it anyway.
So this is your first novel, and it's also your first young adult novel. I'm interested in kind of how you see the genre and what you did either writing or content-wise to think about a younger audience for this book.
That's so funny. I think about that a lot, actually. And I remember I asked one of my favorite authors at a panel who I thought her characters were like very adult. I was like, "Why did you make it young adult?" And this was such an interesting question in my mind. And she was like, "That's because young people deserve stories too. Like, why are you asking me this?" And I was like, "Okay, that's not what I meant." But I think about it now, you know, like why I'm working on another book right now. And as I'm working on it, I'm like, should this be adult actually? I don't know. You know, I think that there's the reason I still read young adult as an actual adult, you know, I'm in my 40s. There's this transitory nature of like your 15, 16, 17, 18, you know, early 20s year old, where life, childhood is ending and adult life is just beginning. And I think that threshold is just such an exciting place for story to kind of take place. And that's why so many people still are drawn to that. And I think why I'm drawn to writing about it, even though I didn't really have anything very exciting happen to me at 16.
Well, that, I mean, novel, not memoir, right?
Exactly.
Were there certain characters or plot points that were really easy for you to tap into and write?
Well, I'm laughing because my parents are sitting here going, "Yeah, some parts of it were easy. Those are literally us." The first thing my dad said, there's a scene where they're working at a construction site and they're kind of like sabotaging it. And I don't know anything about anything. So I have them like pulling out sprockets or spark plugs. And my dad pulls me aside and he's like, it was really good. It was really good. I loved it. I loved it. Tractors don't have spark plugs.
Fact checked.
I know. I'm like, okay. So like my parents are very present in this story with so much love for my whole family. They're all here and so much love for this town. But some of that love, you know, there's a little gentle ribbing, which they do right back to me. So I feel like it's fine. But yes, that was very easy because I could just type words that have come out of their mouths.
Is there anything else that you want to add or anything you want listeners to know about you or about this book?
Oh, boy. I guess I'd love to. This makes me very nervous. It makes me very nervous to say that, but that's a growth edge, right? So we're gonna do it. I would love to come talk to schools. I spoke to my kids' class at Kamehameha, and I'm actually going to talk at Waimea School next week, just because I think it's really important for Hawaiian kids to see their story reflected. It kind of opened the conversation about folklore and about their own experiences. So yeah, that's something I would like to do. It does make me very nervous.
Why?
Oh, I'm just really shy.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Nikki, for taking the time.
Thank you. This was really fun.
That was author Nikki Vandekar and HPR's Maddie Bender. Vandekar's young adult novel, The Invisible Wild, is on sale now. The author will be at Basically Books in Hilo on May 31st for an event at 3:30 p.m. Look for links on the conversation page of our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com. Next month, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton series presents a local jazz lineup you won't want to miss. Each Saturday in June, enjoy live performances from the Honolulu Jazz Quartet, Noel Okimoto, DeShannon Higa's Quad Pod, and the Sean Connolly Quartet. Learn more at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
Return to our backyard quiz, where we asked you to name the 8-year-old performer who will be starring in the live-action version of Lilo and Stitch. She said that one of her favorite parts of the experience was working to recreate an emotional moment in a hammock from the original film, but she's been tight-lipped on details. The hammock scene is so touching and sad at the same time, the actress told E! News. I'm going to be the spoiler of the movie, so I'm not going to give you that much detail. The success hasn't gone to her head, though. She is still a fan at heart. Last November, she walked the red carpet at the Moana 2 premiere, meeting a hero of hers, Auli'i Cravalho, the voice of Moana. Here is the new live-action Lilo introducing herself.
I am Maya Kealoha. I am Lilo in the live-action Lilo and Stitch. It's going to be so fun. I can't wait for you guys to see it.
Oh, adorable. Maya Kealoha, that was the answer that we were looking for today's quiz. We got no winners today. If you have a quiz you want to share, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, the public got the first look at the live-action film Lilo and Stitch in California on Saturday. The production debuts in local theaters later this week. But even before its debut, criticism was building in some circles over casting. HBR's Cassie Ordonez joins us to talk about the controversy. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what's the deal?
So there's been a lot of criticisms among the casting over the live action Lilo and Stitch involving the actress who is playing Nani, which is Sydney Agudong, who is a Kauai local. And so far, a lot of the folks who are taking to social media to criticize the casting of the person playing Nani, they don't know if she's Native Hawaiian or not. And Sydney Agudong, I've tried to reach out to her and her team to kind of address the criticisms, but I haven't had any luck. So there are some folks who are saying she is Native Hawaiian. Some people say she's not Native Hawaiian, and it's still not clear. This blowback actually stems from the lack of Native Hawaiian representation, and not only just the lack of Native Hawaiian representation in film, but those with darker skin complexions. And Hollywood has historically excluded Indigenous voices in film, especially when it comes to Pacific Islander stories. And we look at films going back to the 2015 Aloha that features Emma Stone, who is casted as Allison Ng, a character who's supposed to be Hawaiian and Asian. There's been criticisms among that. And then going back in time to the 1932 film Bird of Paradise, that was also a controversial film that featured kind of this hypersexualization of Pacific Islander women with kind of the appeal to the white male gaze. I spoke with Randisha Chrysostomo, who's a Chamorro scholar who teaches a class on moving images in Oceania, and she talks about the Western colonial institutions being detrimental to people of color in the film industry and how the camera is designed for the Western gaze.
Within empirical systems, while Blackness was consumed, oftentimes consumed and capitalized upon by the empirical body, brownness and indigeneity was always one that was actively removed. So you have the act, one side is like the active consumption of Blackness, and we can see it today, right? Like, although there's not Blackface, there's the hyper consumption of like rap and Black culture into today's spaces, especially by artists who are not Black or not a person of color. And then you have the active removal of Indigenous people from lands, active removal of space, or already imagining them as not being there in the first place. The active removal of Indigenous peoples, unless they're made, and the way that both are represented by the Western body or by the colonial court will is only at moments where they're the most convenient. And I feel like the film industry is definitely at like the microcosm of that, right? Or the intersection where it makes and capitalizes upon the bodies of people of color when we're at the most convenient.
And so when she's talking about this issue, we're also looking at possible brown facing. There's like people on TikTok that were saying that Sydney Agudong allegedly was doing like the spray tan on set. But when you look at her casting photos, she appears to be more lighter complexion. But when you look at the trailer, she appears to be more of darker complexion. But Tuya Onis-Ganlin, who's the president of Local 665, which is the union representing the behind-the-scenes employees of the entertainment industry, he said that Native Hawaiians shouldn't be subject to playing only Native Hawaiian roles, and he underscored that the Lilo and Stitch movie is a fictional story.
Yes, it is very important to have more Native Hawaiian and Polynesian representation on screen. I think it's also really important to acknowledge that this actress booked the role. And when the casting call goes out, it's able to portray, right? In some of the things that are coming up, like Chief of War, you know, a storied ruler of one of, you know, the most prolific eras in our history, Kahikili is played by one of our cousins from across Mauna Nui Akea, right? There is a Maori actor that is playing a Hawaiian ruler. And at the same time, that person is very recognizable. They are a fan favorite. They have been in many different roles and celebrated as a Polynesian actor. I want to say that the criticisms, while I can hear the one side of it, on the other hand, don't want to take away from the idea that, you know, a multiracial person could be portrayed as Nani, right? Also talking about, even though it is based in Hawaii, it is complete fiction, right? This is a movie about an alien landing in Hawaii.
Yeah, and then, you know, more recently we had the controversy over The Rock, right, playing, you know.
It was in, a Maui
in Moana.
Yeah, in
right.
Moana.
And he is, you know, Samoan. He's not Hawaiian. And then also when he was, his name was being tossed around for Kamehameha. Same thing. People were criticizing. He's not Hawaiian. He's Samoan. So,
that's right.
Yeah. Nothing new, but yeah, I guess it just comes with the territory.
It does, and it also goes back to kind of the lack of representation of Native Hawaiians on screen, especially playing a protagonist role. We look back in history in the early 20th century where Pacific Islanders in general were normally the antagonists. In the early Hollywood films, blackface and brownface was normalized. It wasn't okay, but it was normalized for that time period. And when that was happening, Pacific Islanders were portrayed as like the eye candy for the male or female gaze. They were portrayed as any like the stereotypical like unintelligent or having fun in the sun kind of thing. They were never portrayed as the protagonist. And I'm going back to the 1932 film Bird of Paradise because I remember learning about it in my Pacific Island Studies class, but also rewatching it doing reporting for this story. There were Native Hawaiian actors in that movie. Some were born in 1875. But they were in the background. They were never the protagonist role. And Pualalea Panaeva, who's a Native Hawaiian actress, said she underscores that, you know, it's important to see that representation of herself in a protagonist role on screen.
A'ai ka hula, waiho ka hila hila makahale. A'ai ka hula, waiho ka hila hila makahale. So get up and dance and leave the bashfulness, the shyness at home. Just go for them. Go charge them. Literally just uncle auntie advice. But like, that's the best advice ever. Is like, you literally don't have anything to lose. They're already losing out there. Like, there's nothing you do that'll contribute to that being worse. Like, you can, if you're going out there, like, just being Hawaiian and trying to go in the industry and knowing the kuleana, that's already enough. That's a reward in itself to me. It means a lot seeing other Hawaiians like going into the industry and voicing their mana'o and ike on like, yeah, I want to see our people out there. Like, I want our stories to be told, but by us. First and foremost for us. Everybody else, like the rest of the audience, whoever, but like first and foremost for ourselves, because we want that.
There has been an uptick of representation of different ethnic backgrounds on screen. We see, like, especially the Aotearoa films or the New Zealand films, like Whale Riders. Once Were Warriors is also a really good film where they actually see, like, a female protagonist playing this very strong woman role and standing up to her abuser. So there has been, you know, the film industry has come a long way, but some people still say that the film industry has a long way to go.
All right. Okay. And then we should note that the actress who played Nani, you said that she, in a previous interview, had said she was Polynesian.
Yeah. Her her younger sister actually said she was a Polynesian of Polynesian descent.
Okay. All right. Well, stay tuned. But thank you so much,
Thanks
Cassie.
For having me.
That was HBR Culture and Arts reporter Cassie Ordonio talking about some of the early controversy surrounding the new Lilo and Stitch movie. Find her stories at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we turn our attention to another Hula research project. Nearly a decade after it formed, a halau of cancer survivors is thriving. Have a story idea to share with us? Maybe a Hula story? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.